Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another FIA Group webinar. It's great to be here. My name is Adam Russo. I am your host. With me, as always, is our Senior VP and General Counsel, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Good afternoon.
Whoa. That's the first time in 6 years that Ron just hasn't repeated the... Ron, please, could you do this again? We can't do that because this might be the worst webinar ever.
To understand what's happening here, to understand what's happening here, be sure to tune in to our podcast.
Ron, please, just start over. Ron. Hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
All right, feel much better now.
All right.
As always, our fan favorite, the one everyone is here for, Jen McCormick, our Vice President of Consulting. Say hello, Jen.
Hello.
And lastly, the guy that we just can't seem to get rid of, even though all of his predictions have been wrong over the past 6 months. Actually, Ron, I think we could actually do a webinar of all of Brady's wrong predictions. We can do that next month. It would probably be the highest attended webinar that we've had to date. But here for our political insight would be Brady Bizarro. Say hello, Brady.
Hello, Brady.
Folks, it's renewal season. It's fun time of year to be in self-funding. We all know it's September, October. We're all getting ready to go to the SIA conference in a couple weeks. Everyone complains that why do they have the conference in October when it's the busiest time of year? That's why we do it, so that you have more to complain about. So today's session is it's time to renew revisiting stop-loss trends. Folks, a lot of people in the industry come to us asking us to review their policies. But I got a really interesting email today to make me think about things. And it's not always just what the policy says, but it's actually what that particular carrier or MGU does, or the reinsurer does. You can have the same exact policy for two different organizations. One treats it very differently than the other. One more is more aggressive or willing to pay a claim, whereas the other one wants more detail, more information, and delays payment of a claim with the same exact language at hand. So what we talk about here is not only the policies in question, but also what the organizations behind those policies actually do from a claims payment process. I think it's really important to know. Really quick, we want to give a shout-out. Yesterday, Jen McCormick and I got to go to the beautiful city of Cincinnati. Want to give a shout-out to our friends at Custom Design Benefits. I know Julie Mueller is not listening, but I'm sure her employees are. So if you let her know that I gave her a shout-out, too, that would be greatly appreciated. In addition, there's a college student out there at the University of Iowa, Jacob Hennigan, who is a big fan of the FIA Group and what we do. I guess he worked as an intern at True North Companies in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And he's a big fan of FIAs. We have a care package coming out to you, my friend, for all the wonderful things you said about me. So if you just said things about Ron, we wouldn't have sent you anything. But since you said such great things about me, you got everything coming to you, man. A FIA backpack, headbands, sweatbands. We got the whole care package going out to him. The whole FIA 80s pack is coming. Yes, it is. Even a Walkman, a FIA-labeled Walkman, is coming your way. But, again, thanks to you for reaching out, and thank you so much for dialing in and listening in. So, as always, we want people to know, make sure you follow us on LinkedIn. Feel free to follow me. Feel free to follow FIA. We have, I think, 1,800 followers right now. It's been a great job done by our social media director in that regard. Ron, I think you have, like, 8,000 followers.
Hey.
Not quite close to the 11,500 I have.
I'm pushing close to 9, but I could use all the help I can get. So.
Right. So, guys, help Ron out. Follow Ron. We're going to do a hashtag follow Ron on Twitter so that Ron can get some followers. But honestly, guys, you can find out information about our webinars, our podcasts, et cetera, right there. Our podcast, feel free to go to Apple Podcasts. Yes, we are that cool. We are available on the iPhone 8 even, and hopefully soon the iPhone 10, which, of course, I'm going to get.
Oh, yeah.
Of course I'm going to have that.
You are an early adopter, Adam.
I am always. I was the first person at FIA to have the first iPhone back in 27.
That was something.
Right. So make sure that you listen to us on podcast. Last but not least, we want you to check out Chapter 13 of the CEO's Guide to Restoring the American Dream, Dave Chase's great book. Ron and I wrote Chapter 13. It is the best section of the book.
Yeah, you could ignore the rest of the book.
Right, I wouldn't even read the rest, but read Chapter 13, surely. It'll talk about the differences between a TPA and ASO and so forth. If you want a copy of an actual hardcover book, let me know or Ron know directly. Otherwise, you can actually download a copy of the book and read it online if you feel like it as well by going to that website that we have here. Where is it? There it is, healthrosetta.org/the FIA Group/#download, right? Just call us.
That's
much easier than doing all that. All right, the next slide, here we go. Why do I bring this up? Everything that we're doing here at FIA Group that we're sharing with you, these things, all things that we're doing internally, If it doesn't work in fiat, we don't share it with the rest of the industry. We don't share in revenues on things. We do things for the industry because it betters the industry and it betters our company itself. We have a full-time recruiter here at the company who does nothing but look for people that want to work for our organization, that want to work for someone like Ron. It's tough to do. It's tough to find people that want to work for you, Ron.
It's a needle in a haystack.
That's why we have that recruiter in-house. But here's the bottom line, folks. If you are a single person at FIA, like Brady, even though you live at home, you can still only pay $127 a month, Brady, on the FIA health plan, have no copay for generic drugs, no copay for urgent care, even though all your cohorts who have their own apartments, unlike you, are paying $554 a month for health insurance and have an average copay of $25. I have no idea if you live at home, Brady. I'm just... That'd be fun to say.
Paint a great picture, Adam.
Living at home, doing political talk. Yeah.
We're not covering his parents, though, even though he lives in their basement.
Somebody mentioned to us in a question, what about Chapter 2? Folks, I have no idea what Chapter 2 even says. I didn't even read it yet, so I skipped that chapter, I think. But anyway, our family plan, which myself, my wife, and our four kids are on, $357 versus the $1,320 you pay on average in the state of Massachusetts. Why do we do it? We talk about it all the time. Incentives, 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 and also having the right stop-loss policy in effect. So when we do have a big claim, we have the right stop-loss coverage there to protect us from any potential gaps. These are what our actual cost per employees are versus what they see right now in our region, which is New England, and our employer size, which is 250 employees and less, and our industry type, which I guess is consulting.
Consulting, yeah.
So we're paying roughly 50 to 60%, depending on which one you want to use, of what other self-funded plans are doing in the region. So when we talk about being a PhD-level plan, empowering your employees and empowering your plan, this is precisely what we're doing. Today, as always, you know who the speakers are. You have our email addresses there. Again, Brady, let's see if any of the predictions he does today work. So far, I think he's, what, 0 for 18, 0 for 19? I mean, we can go back to some of the podcasts. I mean, some of the stuff that he said will be done by May. I mean, it's almost October.
Yeah.
It's okay, Brady. You're 6 months off. Next slide. Here's what we're going to talk about. Brady's going to give you a political update. Basically, if you want to tune out for the next 10 minutes, do so. We're not sure if anything he says is going to be right, but we're going to make sure we ask him what the predictions will be. We will have our lovely Jen McCormick do a PGC FAQ. These are all the top things that all of you out there are asking us to assist you with. Then we're going to talk about different topics as it relates to stop loss. How it's affected by reference-based pricing. More and more of you are interested in reference-based pricing. We're going to talk about that. PPO versus UNC. It's a major gap. You have a PPO that says you're going to pay a claim a certain way. You have a plan doc that says you have to pay a claim based on the usual, reasonable, customary, maximum allowable charge, etc. They differ. Big gaps are there. Soft gaps, which are the gaps that you can't see just here. Those are more of the actions that carriers take. Hard gaps are literally gaps that if you have two eyes that can see, you should see right in front of you and say to yourself, I need to make my clients aware of that. Take a highlighter, highlight it, let them know, hey, no problem. The premium is $75,000 less than the other guys, but don't just be aware of this real gap in coverage. Next, payment. The how and the when, I think, Ron, are you going to be talking about that?
Sure.
It's always wrong when it comes to claim payment. It's that mail. Every time I think of mailbox room, I think of Professor Peck. Last but not least, begging for forgiveness or asking for permission. I'm assuming that's a Ron title. Is that you again?
You're very good at this game.
It's Ron again. All right, next slide. And now we're going to turn it over to Brady. Brady, tell us all about Medicare for All, which will never pass, and the Graham Cassidy bill that you said, I want to make sure I got this right, 60% chance of passing. Is that right? You're telling all the thousands of people on this.
I mean,
60% is what you said.
Bank on it. If I can get a word in, I can probably defend my predictions here.
Oh.
Spicy.
So listen, thanks, Adam. So last week what we had was essentially the tale of two proposals. We had what amounts to be the last-ditch attempt by Republicans to really get a repeal and replace bill passed. And we had Bernie Sanders, who introduced the bill that was about Medicare for All. So we're going to talk about these two a little bit in detail and more on Graham Cassidy, which could get a vote in the next 10 days or so. And so what exactly is this bill? Well, this was really the genesis of two senators, Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, and Bill Cassidy, Louisiana, who came up with the idea of what I would call Obamacare repeal light. And it's basically really the last attempt Republicans have to repeal Obamacare. That's because at the end of the month,
At the end of September, they will no longer be able to use the reconciliation process, meaning any attempt at health care reform going forward is going to require 60 votes, meaning it's going to require Democratic support. Pretty hard to get these days in Washington. So this is a big deal. What do we have in this final repeal and replace bill, which, by the way, many Republican governors support, including President Trump? Well, essentially what it does is it replaces the money that's currently given to states for things like the premium tax credits, for the cost-sharing reductions, which are subsidies given to insurance companies to help defray the cost of care for low-income people, and the money given to states for Medicaid expansion, and basically gives them one big block grant. As Senator Graham said in one of his press conferences, he just punts this back to the states and says, you figure out your own ways to cover high-risk people. You want to use high-risk pools? Go for it. But they get the money to spend on their own, and that's a pretty popular conservative idea. So is, by the way, repealing the individual and employer mandates. So we're loosening some of the ACA requirements. There's also going to be, and this slide wasn't updated in time, but they actually do have waivers that they will allow states to apply for. Also something we saw in the last iteration of this bill, where states can apply to opt out of things like essential health benefit coverage. And one important thing I want to know, and if anyone watched Jimmy Kimmel this week, you would have perhaps seen this discussed, but the issue of pre-existing conditions. This bill, technically what it states is that if states want to opt out of coverage for those with conditions, what they have to do is provide what's called adequate replacement coverage. We don't know what that means, but that's sort of the fallback that Republicans are using to say, no, we're not getting rid of those protections. Many people on the other side of the aisle and some policy analysts think that that's not quite enough. They don't really trust what's there, but just know that that language is there. Finally, there's a cap on federal spending on Medicaid. So why is this bill, do I think, have a decent shot of passing? Well, for one, it's the last gasp attempt. Another thing is there's a deadline here, and nothing really moves Congress like a deadline. Like, as I said, at the end of the month here, Republicans have to face the prospect of not repealing and replacing the ACA, and we're stuck with it for, you know, the foreseeable future, and that's a pretty hard thing to swallow. So where we're at now is we have about 48 senators. The ones that are holdouts, the ones you would expect, right? Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine, John McCain, who, by the way, said he's closely reviewing this bill. If we can get, or if they can get, rather, two of them to sign on to get that 50-vote threshold, you have the vice president break the tie, this will pass. And then I think what you'll see is it'll be the first step in a long process of dismantling the ACA.
How is this going to affect our clients, our self-funded employers?
So if it passes, because of the fact that it would repeal the employer mandate and it would loosen restrictions on employers on ACA coverage requirements. So they would allow waivers for certain states. So if you picked a state that was permitted a waiver to, say, opt out of essential health benefit coverage, then you could use that state as your benchmark, right, and not have to provide as
– So a plan to match, so our plan here can use the state of Wyoming's benchmark, if we think it's low enough, to decide not to cover certain things.
Correct. And if the state of Wyoming applies for a waiver and the Secretary of HHS grants the waiver and the state provides, quote, an adequate replacement for protections of people with pre-existing conditions, then the waiver will be granted and what they have to cover will be a lot less of a robust package and try to help benefit package. That's how it can affect our industry. One last thing on that is the taxes. This bill does actually keep quite a few of the ACA taxes because the revenue collected by that taxes is what's being used to fund the block grants. And that's a quick rundown of that bill. Watch for a CBO, Congressional Budget Office report early next week on who this might affect in terms of coverage, and a vote could happen by the end of next week. So you're going to hear a lot more about this going forward.
So we'll have a podcast on this, obviously, if something happens here. But Brady, are you putting money on this passing? How much money?
I mean, maybe we'll see. I'll tell you offline. I'll tell you offline. I can't.
Tell the people. Is this going to pass or no?
I mean,
It's tough.
Just
say yes or no.
Right, I'm gonna say no.
No.
The 40%.
All right.
I think it'll be a showdown like we had in July, where there might be some decisive, dramatic vote.
But he said no. Everyone write that down. Brady said.
Yeah, I think that'll be the case. We'll see.
Right.
So, all right. Gonna happen. Let me just run through something that I know for sure. I'll put money on this one. This is definitely not gonna pass. So, if you want to bet, Adam, I'll double my salary on this one. Medicare for All is not going to pass.
Why is it important to bring it up?
It's important because the first time this was brought up by Bernie Sanders almost a decade ago, nobody supported him on this topic, on this issue. There's been a lot more waves being made on this issue to the tune of a third of Senate Democrats sort of back this bill publicly, which is a big deal. People are willing to come out and say, yeah, we like the idea of single payer. We're moving toward that option. What would be in his proposed bill? He did release a pretty detailed bill, surprisingly, on this. expanding Medicare over 4 years by age group. Eventually, it will become Medicare for all. There will be an annual budget for covered health services. Benefits will be expanded to include coverage of dental care, hearing aids, things like that. Comprehensive reproductive maternity and newborn care, including for abortion. A standard list of covered drugs. I mean, this all sounds very popular, right? Eliminate deductibles and most other out-of-pocket costs. But keep co-pays to, I should say, encourage the use of lower-cost generic drugs. So there's one cost containment thing in this plan that we can see. What it means for our industry, employers, very importantly, would not be allowed to duplicate the benefits provided by this universal program, meaning you probably wouldn't have any employer-sponsored care at all. You could offer extra benefits, like coverage for private hospital rooms.
Like what they do in Europe. You buy a policy, right. Exactly. A private insurance policy that gives you access to private hospitals that the public doesn't go to.
Yep. But that would destroy the vast majority of employer-sponsored plans.
Got it.
And again, here's the key issue. How would he pay for it? We just don't know. It could cost $1.4 trillion or more.
He tried it in Vermont, his own state, and right. It failed there.
Yep.
But it's going to pass, but it's going to work for the whole country.
I mean, the important point, again, is that we're seeing more on this, and the political reality is it's probably not going to happen now. There's a tricky schedule for the Cassidy-Graham bill. We'll be watching it. But the fact that the Senate is even talking about single payer is a big deal. But rest assured, 150 million people in this country receive their health care from their employers. That would end with single payer. I don't think it's going to end. And, you know, we'll keep watching the Senate as they have these hearings on, you know, for now, fixing the ACA. But one thing's for sure, we're going to hear more about this soon.
All right.
Jen?
Awesome. Thank you. Okay, so as we're getting close to the end of the year or the beginning of next year, that does mean that it's time for renewals. It's time to start talking about revisions. It's time to start talking about what I need to do to prepare. So some of the questions that we are seeing with some frequency, the first one, does a plan sponsor need to provide a translated copy of the plan document or SMM in a foreign language? The short answer is no, this is not necessarily required by ERISA. However, there are certain requirements that ERISA does impose as it relates to providing information to individuals who need some sort of assistance in a non-English language if there are a certain number of individuals who are otherwise covered in the plan. So note that the plan document and SMM requirements are different than the SBC requirements and the appeals notice rules as well. So, but as it relates to the plan document, that is not necessarily a requirement. The requirement is if you have a certain threshold of individuals who are covered under your plan that speak a particular non-English language, then a certain notice requirement does need to be included in the plan. So now would be a good time to take a look at the population and see if there's any sort of notice requirements that the document might need so you compare that for the upcoming renewal. Question two, can a benefit plan request information to prove a dependent relationship to the member or status as a dependent? So the answer to this, obviously, is my favorite. It depends. And the answer is it depends on the plan language. So we always recommend that the plan has discretionary authority within the document to provide the plan administrator the opportunity to request certain information as possible. We frequently see that this discretionary authority is outlined within the dependent section. So there can be a specific grant to the plan administrator, the plan sponsor, to request certain information to confirm that there is still a relationship, that the individuals have not yet been divorced or separated, that the dependent has not yet turned 65 or turned 60 or 26 and is still eligible for coverage under the plan. The best way to set this up is not necessarily through language alone, but with language plus a process. And the process would be to have an annual dependent eligibility audit where on a non-discriminatory basis, this is something that the plan does to ensure that all of the information they have on file is accurate and appropriate. And this can prevent issues that could potentially later arise if there was someone, a dependent potentially, who remained on the plan who wasn't potentially eligible and maybe they had claims that went to stop loss. So in order to prevent that from happening, it's going to be important to do those audits and stay on top of those dependent relationships so you can prevent that. Question three, if a benefit plan provides for automatic enrollment of newborn children, can coverage be retroactively terminated or rescinded to the date of birth if the child is not enrolled within 30 days? So it's pretty popular that plans have language within their documents that says that the individual has 30 days to enroll the child within the newborn child within the plan. And with that language, there's been some confusion about what happens if the individual, the parent, does not properly enroll that child. If you don't properly enroll that child, but you have that language in there that implies that there might be some coverage for the first 30 days, would you be rescinding coverage in a violation of ACA? Well, that's when we're going to take a look at those HIPAA special enrollment rules. So the first question is, if I do enroll the child within those 30 days, would I be allowed then to retroactively allow coverage to start as of the day of the birth? The answer to that question is yes. But if I don't properly enroll the child, would I have had to offer coverage for those first 30 days? Of course, there's a situation where you have to look at this at the particular facts that are involved. But if the child wasn't properly enrolled, if premiums weren't properly paid, you're not rescinding coverage that didn't otherwise exist. So the answer to that one is probably no, it'd be okay. So you need to take a look at all these different situations on a case-by-case basis. The reason we're bringing these up now is we're talking about dependents and enrolling individuals in the plan. If there's improper enrollment or maybe someone who's improperly remaining on the plan and claims arise, this could allow for a potentially expensive claim situation that could arise to the level of stop loss. So we want to make sure that as we're going towards renewal season, we're taking a look at these situations and preventing these from actually becoming problems under the plan. All right, with that, I think I'm going to turn it back over to Ron.
Jen, I just want to say, you know, have a great 3 days vacation with your husband in Nantucket.
Oh.
Hopefully they have nice weather this weekend. She's going away for a couple of days.
So. Now everybody knows where to go if they want to get an autograph. All right.
Head to the island. We'll give her the address she's at, too.
Flooded.
Yeah. Just like everywhere else. So now let's actually talk a little bit about the meat of today's topic, stop loss. And in particular, I'm going to talk a little bit about stop loss and its relationship with reference-based pricing. Before I do that, I just want to make sure everybody who's listening understands what reference-based pricing is. For those of you who don't know, reference-based pricing, in a nutshell, is a trending new methodology for replacement of a network. You know that a PPO network basically serves two functions. One, it applies a discount to the charges, and two, it dictates how much needs to be paid to the provider to prevent the provider from balance billing anybody else, meaning it's payment in full if they get that amount. Reference-based pricing definitely addresses the first sort of role or characteristic of a PPO network, that being that reference-based pricing dictates how much is paid by the plan. What reference-based pricing does not do, which networks do handle, is pretty much dictate if you do this, there's no balance billing, period. So as a result, as people are replacing their networks with a reference-based pricing model, you often hear people use the word Medicare Plus, but take note, Medicare is just one of many different reference tools or referral tools used in reference-based pricing, but there are other things you need to look at as well, because many of these plans cover things Medicare wouldn't cover. So, but Medicare, of course, being one of the primary tools or numbers that we use when determining a proper reference-based price, like I said, it dictates how much is payable. It doesn't really address the balance billing. And so how we deal with balance billing is sort of the riddle that everybody's trying to figure out. And one of the key issues when dealing with balance billing is what role does stop loss play? And that takes us into today's conversation. Because if I have a reference-based pricing plan, I'm paying, let's say, a percentage of Medicare. I pay a percentage of Medicare to the hospital. Claim is paid. There's no balance billing. My policy, it terms, you know, 2-3 years pass. And suddenly now the hospital's balance billing the patient. They're coming after the plan for more money. And I'm looking to stop loss. And I'm saying, hey, if I end up paying something beyond my deductible, do you have my back? Well, that's a really good question. And for a lot of plans that are thinking about reference-based pricing, knowing whether stop loss has their back is one of the major issues they need resolved before they're going to pull the trigger and actually try reference-based pricing. And before we get into the two main issues where stop loss relates to reference-based pricing, I want everybody to note this is not only just for full reference-based pricing. This includes things like carve-outs, right, dialysis only, reference-based pricing, if you're being balance billed just on one of those claims, will stop loss cover it? This includes if you're using a primary network, a narrow network, direct contracted providers, and thus you're only applying reference-based pricing to out-of-network claims. Again, how is stop loss going to react to those? Which type of reference-based pricing you're using will probably control how stop loss reacts. but these issues will definitely be the same no matter what.
Hey, really quick, Ron, in regards to that, one of the key things people always say to me is, well, if we have a claim with an RVP plan, then we have to negotiate. Don't we have to have the stop-loss carrier agree to reimburse that higher amount of money? And I say is no. At least just find out ahead of time, is the stop-loss carrier only going to reimburse you up to the actual language in the plan, or is it going to give you a little bit of tug or a little bit of ability to play with those numbers a little bit? Either way, just know ahead of time. That's all.
Absolutely. Great transition, Adam. It's almost as if you looked at these slides ahead of time.
I did.
We practiced all day. To Adam's point, this is a conversation that needs to be had ahead of time because, generally speaking, we see two different types of stop-loss carriers in reaction to reference-based pricing. One basically says, look, we're just going to provide coverage for the amount paid in accordance with the terms of the plan document. If the plan later decides to pay something extra to negotiate and resolve a balance bill, that's fine, that's on them, but we're not going to reimburse the plan for that additional payment. We only reimburse up to the amount paid in accordance strictly with the terms of the plan. That's fine if that carrier is going to be offering you really competitive rates and you're actually seeing savings on this plan, because the attitude then is all the savings you're seeing between a lower premium and reference-based pricing, you can then apply that. You can apply that to whatever occasional negotiation there is, and you don't need stop-loss to cover the negotiated amounts. On the flip side, you have stop-loss carriers that actually say, look, what we're going to do is we're going to keep the claim open. If you need to negotiate, we'll recognize that negotiated payment as reimbursable, but within certain parameters that we have to set up ahead of time, meaning you don't just have a blank check from stop loss. You have to understand, being able to keep the claim open with stop loss, if they're going to reimburse, if it's the first type and they say, we only cover up to the plan payment, nothing additional, none of this matters. But if it's a stop loss carrier that's going to have your back and could reimburse portion or all of the negotiated payment, knowing how long you have to negotiate is a key issue because these things can last forever. And before we get to the next slide, real quick, I want to let you know, a lot of people react to this and they say, well, I understand that they may start balance billing years later, but they can't do that because the plan says they need to appeal within 30 days.
That's the patient.
Ladies and gentlemen, the patient, the beneficiary, if appealing the plan's payment, yes, there are rules. But if I'm a provider looking to enforce a contract against the patient, right, that's a breach of contract action. That's not an appeal to the plan. And guess what? Breach of contract, you've got years. The statute of limitations. The provider is not appealing. They don't care what your plan document says. That is not what balance billing is. So, again, the whole appeal timeline, ignore it. It's a contract issue. That's the statute of limitations. That's why it's important to know how long stop loss will be available. Note also, that's going to differ depending on whether you continue to have the same carrier year after year or the carrier that was in place when the claims were first incurred has since left, and you have a different carrier now. These are all things that need to be determined ahead of time. Another issue is, again, how much are they going to cover? So let's say we've already gone through the first exercise, and the carrier says, we're so happy you're going to try reference-based pricing. You're going to save so much money. We're going to save so much money. This is great. And in order to encourage it, we agree that if you're ever balance billed, even if we're not the carrier anymore, we've got your back. You know, we're going to keep the claim open. And then you say, that's great. How much can I negotiate? You can negotiate an additional 1%. Wow. Thanks, guys. So, again, knowing how much they actually have your back, not just how long they have your back, matters as well.
But, again, don't forget, most policies out there, most carriers, are not going to agree to pay an additional percentage, which is fine. Just know that if you make an additional percentage, you're on the hook, not the carrier. I can tell you right now, what we have seen recently is carriers adjusting their premium rates to higher ones if they actually believe and see that you're not paying 140% of Medicare, you're paying 180.
Absolutely.
They will retroactively adjust your premium.
They'll look at the data and they'll start realizing you're ignoring the plan document and right. They're going to base it on the actual payment. So these are things that need to be discussed. This is a determination you need to make, and do not assume that stop loss will cover negotiated rates if your plan document doesn't explicitly say that you pay negotiated rates, which I've really never seen a reference-based pricing plan that openly says, we'll pay Medicare plus 40, but we'll negotiate and pay anything you charge us if you're willing to push back.
Right.
You put that in writing, you're done for. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brady to talk a little bit more about pricing and, in this case, usual customary.
Thanks, Ron. So one of the most common gaps, which we would classify as a, quote, hard gap that we see, involves plans that use PPO networks. And surprise, most plans do use PPO networks, so it's one of the most common gaps that we see. So this gap arises because most stop-loss policies that we've seen, and in general, define usual and customary independent of the terms of the plan document itself, and they don't take network rates into account. In fact, some policies actually have exclusions for amounts that are paid pursuant to any other contract other than the SPD, such as a PPO contract. And different carriers treat this differently, and if you're not sure how yours will, you'll find yourself with a significant hard gap problem. So let's take a look at an example of how this can occur. In this case, the claim was incurred, $305,500, subject to a 22% PPO network discount. In this case, the plan paid the claim at the PPO rate of $238,290. And yes, I did the math on that. That's exactly right. That's 2015 numbers. In this case, the stop-loss carrier repriced that claim based on Medicare, Medicare Plus, pursuant to the policy, meaning the policy allowed it to reprice in that way.
So, again, that's a hard gap. It actually said that wording in the policy, so you can't say how they get that number.
Right. This is not an interpretation problem. This is literally just allowed for in the contract itself. It's the carrier reading its own contract. And when they did that, they denied over $164,000 in reimbursement to the plan. And in this particular case, the dispute is ongoing. So how do you fix that problem? Again, make sure if your carrier has a separate definition of usual and customary, you want to talk to them first and see how they're going to handle these kinds of claims. And if they do have an exclusion for amounts that are paid pursuant to other contracts like PPO contracts, be aware of that, because you're going to have – that's basically creating an implicit gap right between your plan and between a stop-loss policy. And you don't want to be caught in a situation like this plan is in, where now, you know, over six figures in claims and reimbursement is being denied. And that's probably not the only claim they're having this issue on.
But again, just to make sure, Brady, those are the easiest gaps to find.
Oh, yeah.
You can just look at the stop-loss policy, read definition or exclusion, and see. We're going to go into detail on all the other ones. I'm going to talk about that a bit. To me, the gaps that are the tough ones are the soft gaps, where it's not clearly written. There's an interpretation provision. There's something language in there that's a little, I don't want to say shady, but, you know, you're not seeing it. So, Jen, you want to get into that?
Yeah, we have Jen doing those hard ones. So.
Yeah, of course we do.
Jen, go ahead.
Well, talking about those hard gaps, this is the soft gap. So, there are the two different types of the gaps, right? There's the hard gap that Adam's going to talk about and the soft gap. So when it comes to these soft gaps, there will be – get this closer to me here in case everyone can't hear me. When it comes to the soft gaps, these are going to be easily spottable if you know exactly what you're looking for. And what you're going to be looking for is something within the policy that reserves the right of the carrier to interpret the document or the policy in line with the document as they see fit. So you're not specifically going to be looking for any language where there is a, if you put the provisions side by side, that it's explicitly clear that one says felonies and one says misdemeanors, or one says workers' compensation versus one says may arise as a result of a workers' compensation issue. These are the ones where you're actually going to have to read the entirety of the policy to see where there's going to be the opportunity or the possibility for some language that may actually be exactly the same within the plan versus a policy, or something that is not necessarily very clear. So there, it's very possible there could be a situation where the plan has outlined how they define usual and customary, or they outline how they define a covered service, or they're going to outline how they're going to define experimental and investigational procedures, and then the carrier has an endorsement or a rider, or specifically says they're mirroring or adopting that specific language. Just by having that endorsement or that rider or that language being mirrored, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are closing these soft gaps. That can very well close all of those hard gaps, so there's not actually going to be anything explicit within the language itself, but that's going to leave open the opportunity for discretion and interpretation to mean that the carrier and the plan can reach a very separate conclusion.
We got a really good question that came in on this. Somebody asked, what percentage of carriers have these soft gaps? And we're talking here sidebar. We're guessing about 50% of the policies have some type of right to interpret the plan,
mm-hmm.
and it's in writing. But we're guessing that about 90% actually do it.
Yeah.
So more actually do it than have the right to do it within the terms of their
right.
policy.
Right.
Okay.
So,
great question, folks.
An example of this, when we're talking about whether or not adopting a language versus interpreting a language means the same thing. So, if there is an example within a plan, this was an example that we've actually come across, where the plan document, which is very common, has an exclusion that says that services that are rendered by a family member or a relative are going to be excluded by the plan. It doesn't necessarily say anything in addition to a family member or the relative of the patient. So, in this circumstance, the individual under the plan sought some treatment from a second cousin. Well, I don't know that who was a physician, obviously, in this case. You have to make sure the person is going to be a covered provider, obviously. And this individual sought the treatment from the cousin. And the plan took a look at the circumstances, and in their opinion and in their discretion, they decided this was just a coincidence. This wasn't something that was an excludable circumstance under the plan. They didn't consider this individual to be a relative as defined by the specific plan document. However, in the stop loss policy, there wasn't necessarily any separate exclusion or provision that outlined that claims that had been received or that had been incurred rendered by a relative of the patient would be excluded. Instead, the carrier read the actual language within the plan document, and they interpreted that same exclusion to mean that that second cousin who had rendered that treatment and that service for that individual was considered to be a relative, and thus those claims were denied under the portion of the policy. So that's a great example of when it doesn't necessarily mean that there is going to be a specific language in the or exclusion within the plan documents itself that's going to be a potential problem. It just means potentially that one sentence or that one provision within the policy is going to lead you to potentially have an issue of an interpretation with the carrier.
Guys, people are sending a lot of questions asking us to tell you on air, while recorded, the names of the bad carriers, the names of the good carriers. We cannot do that, folks. We respect the fact that you actually want to know what we think our opinion is. We obviously can't do that. I think you all understand why. You know, maybe at Saya, give Ron like three or four, actually more like a dozen beers, and maybe he'll tell you. But we cannot obviously talk about that for obvious liability reasons. I have four children to feed, so we're not going to do that. Another question came up is in regards to hard gaps. So I'm going to talk about that right now. Hard gaps are really easy. Okay, basically, if you have even a paralegal in your office or anyone that has a college degree, even a high school degree, anyone that can read,
right,
you can take a stop-loss policy, read the definitions and exclusions, and identify areas. But wait a second, I think our plan doc might have that same wording, provision, but a different definition. Here's the bottom line, folks. Any type of title within a stop-loss policy, any section that has the word workers' compensation or experimental investigational or illegal act, you can pretty much guarantee that the wording there is not going to exactly match the wording in your plan doc. That's just, if it was the same, it'd be plagiarism, right? I mean, how could it be the same?
Sure.
That's the bottom line, right? So this is the easy one. This one, we would say 80% of all stop-loss policies have a hard gap, which if you ask me, I like a hard gap because right there it tells you, hey, I might be saving $30,000 in premium versus one that has just mirrors the plan, but at least I know what's not going to be covered, and then I can make a decision as a plan. Am I willing to save $30,000 to add that additional risk?
Right.
Sometimes you may be. You might say, you know what? We're never going to have that happen to us. We're not worried about it, and if it does, we'll pay the entire thing. It's almost like lasering your own situation. Instead of lasering it for a particular patient, you're lasering a particular scenario or event that could happen within your plan population. So, again, if the policy is more restrictive, then the plan might have to pay claims that aren't reimbursable. But there are many times now, and here's a plug, especially if someone has a fear group plan doc, where our language is stronger and even better than the stop-loss policy. So there's a gap there. But in actuality, that gap will never hurt the plan, because the plan would never have paid that much in the first place or even paid the claim in the first place because they got FIA plan language, which is stronger. So there's been many times we're on the phone with the carrier and we actually tell them, guys, why do you even have this hard gap? Your language is weak. Nobody has language that weak. You're better off just mirroring because it's actually making your policy better. And that's what we often see. So here's some examples of what these are is a bunch. Illegal acts. Are you going to restrict, are you going to exclude just all felonies? I mean, all illegal acts or just felonies? Big distinction. Payment time frames, the mailbox rule. Ron's going to talk about that. Experimental treatment, E&I. These are big. These are big, big claims. Off-drug use. A lot of times it's rare forms of cancer, different ways to mix the drugs together. And a lot of times these things work. But yet the stop-loss carrier has a different definition as to whether or not this should be covered. Dependence, same-sex domestic partners. Medical tourism, see that all the time. And independent discretion, so it's not a soft gap. It actually says, they just got the cojones, right?
Right.
We have the right to interpret the terms of your plan.
Right.
At least they're telling you. Next, workers' comp, that's a big one. Some say if you're working for profit, meaning your 24-year-old son, who's under your plan, was mowing a neighbor's lawn for money, that's excluded because it's workers' comp coverage. They should have paid. Usual and customary, that's another big one. Brady talked about that. Leaves of absence, which is one of our favorite soap operas on daytime television. And also extra plan documents, meaning there are other documents outside the plan, meaning the handbook. And as we talked about before, 90% of handbooks and stop and plan documents have gaps between them. We talked about that just this week. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Brady to talk about reporting and data, which is one of the newest forms of gap that we're seeing in the stop-loss world.
Thanks, Adam. So, yeah, I wanted to bring up this slide here because we often see stop-loss disputes that don't have to do particularly with gaps, but do have to do with the terms of the stop-loss policy. And one quick point to back up for a second, based on what Jen was talking about, is keep in mind that stop-loss policies really can include more than one document, right? You could have the application, you could have an amendment, and sometimes you may find rights that are given to the carrier in those extra documents that are then incorporated by reference into the actual policy. And you could be surprised by those. So take a careful look when you are securing stop-loss coverage at all the documents you're signing to make sure that you're not missing something. In this case, okay, we're talking about reporting. What's the problem with reporting here? Don't make assumptions about reporting. Look at your ASA, especially if you're using a third party as your stop-loss carrier. Make sure you know who is reporting what to whom, right? Are you getting a standard reporting package? Are you getting a custom reporting package? Are they actually going to make sure that stop-loss is being notified of large potential claims? These are things that you don't want to be caught off guard for, so I wanted to bring that up and just make sure you double-check that. Also, what is considered adequate proof of loss? This is kind of similar in the same way. Know what's required. Stop-loss policies are very, very generic in terms of proof of loss. Very few that I've seen define what proof of loss means, and the ones that do, they're still very vague definitions. So do they want things like medical records, lab results, eligibility records, case notes? These things may not be as easy to get as you think, or it may take a long time to get. So if you're prepared and you ask for clarification up front when you have a large claim, you'll know or you'll have a better sense of what the carrier is going to consider to be proof of loss, and then you'll have a better chance of getting your claims reimbursed on a timely basis.
This is a big, big issue right now. Is this a big issue? I mean, we're seeing more of these types of claims. I mean, Brady is our in-house expert. You guys call him an expert.
I can't believe it.
What's going on with me today? I'm in a good mood. I think it's my kids are coming in for a pizza day today, so we're in a good mood for that. But this is by far the biggest, most recent trends that we're seeing are these reporting issues that we have with stop loss.
Yeah, you know, before I get into payment, which actually relates to this, it seems to me like the biggest gaps or issues or disputes that we're seeing between a plan and their administrator and stop loss relates to the plan's relationship with a third party. You have a plan that has a PPO contract, right? And then you just assume that if you pay the PPO rate, stop loss is going to reimburse that rate. But your stop loss policy doesn't reference the PPO, doesn't reference network rates, and it basically says that stop loss is just going to reimburse usual customary rates. They're not bound by a PPO contract that you signed. That stop loss carrier didn't sign that contract. Same thing with the reporting. It may be that you're limited in what information you can get from your claims administrator, particularly if you're using one that has proprietary rights to the data, and they don't want to give you everything. Well, stop loss has a contract with you that says they have a right to all that information. The fact that you've signed a contract with some third party that says you can't get it is not the stop loss carrier's problem. So, again, understanding that stop loss is not just magically bound to everything that you agree to with a third party, I think is the key to resolving this problem. And payment is yet another example where you're getting into a relationship with a third party and you're assuming stop loss is going to say, oh, yeah, we're good with that. We're going to sign that contract too. No, they're not. So in this example, if you are using a payment clearinghouse, which most plans that I'm aware of do in one form or another, you're not cutting a check and putting it into a mailbox. You're relying on a third party to do so. So let me actually go through an example of how this works. We had a plan. They had a claim. They decided it was payable. They issued instructions to their clearinghouse to cut the check. The policy year ended at the end of December. Okay, it's a calendar year policy with stop loss. They submitted payment instructions to the clearinghouse well before the 31st. In fact, almost a week. So they figure, hey, no problem. It's been paid, right? Clearinghouse doesn't actually cut the check until well into January. Stop loss finds out. They say payment was not made in time. Okay? So think about that. If you're the TPA or you're the plan, how do you control that? You can't drive to the clearinghouse's office, grab them by the neck, and say, you better pay it now or you're in big trouble, right? I suppose one thing you could do is you put a date on your calendar, and every date after that, every claim processed after that, issue payment yourself. Don't rely on the clearinghouse. Or, alternatively, talk to the stop-loss carrier about revising their definition of payment to indicate that when you issue instructions to the clearinghouse, that constitutes payment. So as long as you did that within the timeline, it would be done. But in this instance, the carrier said, sorry, definition is when the check goes in the mail, your clearinghouse, you, your uncle, it doesn't matter who's cutting the check. They put it in the mailbox on that date. That's the date payment occurred. It didn't occur until January. To make matters even worse, this plan, and this was a while ago, but it's still, sticks in my craw. This plan,
wow,
and their TPA told the carrier, but in the past this has never been a problem. We've told the clearinghouse they didn't cut checks until January and you reimbursed us then. That carrier thanked them for notifying them of those overpayments and requested those payments back as well.
I learned a big lesson then. That was the day that I remember that. I learned a big lesson then, that Ron, that why in the world did I just open up that can of worms? That's when we actually try to use the argument of, well, you did it before.
As performance.
And we realized really bad. I mean, that hurt us a big time, that case.
It did.
So, but we learned a lesson there.
On the next slide, you know, and that kind of ties into this, is the fact that people often take the mentality or the position that they don't want to communicate because they're worried about things like that. This attitude that, you know, it's better to beg for forgiveness than ask permission. And when I hear stories like that, it kind of makes me understand that mentality. The problem is that from the carrier perspective, they want transparency. They want to talk about these potential issues before they happen so that you can figure out either, hey, how to resolve it or at least agree on how it's going to unfold if it happens and therefore plan accordingly. So that communication ahead of time, it's promoted and it's sought by the carrier, but at the same time, you don't want then, if you're a stop-loss carrier, to punish plans and punish TPAs that actually do talk to you about this ahead of time, because then they're never going to talk to you again. And I understand, and I hear it all the time, when we hear about a potential claim that might be excludable, and it may hit stop-loss, and the TPA or the plan, they say to us, hey, guys, you know, we're debating whether to deny the claim or not. We think it's payable, but we could potentially see how someone might think it's deniable. If we pay it, it's going to hit spec, and we need stop-loss to back us up. And your knee-jerk reaction, and I know every carrier out there is saying, talk to us about it. Let's figure it out. Let's work together. This plan is worried that if they tell you about the claim, they're going to draw your attention to the potential exclusion you may not have even thought of applying had they not brought it to your attention. And so they don't tell you about it at all.
The bottom line here, folks, is try to get as much stuff in writing. And also, we want you to be aware, we like the hard gaps. We have no problem with them because you obviously know what's going to happen. I look at it from a standpoint of, if I'm a stop-loss carrier and I have these gaps, I have these hard gaps written in my policy, there's a reason why I'm pricing it the way I am. I'm expecting you to follow not only the terms of your plan, but also my policy as well.
Right.
It's those soft gaps. It's those carriers that have a denied mentality first. They're the ones that we try to urge our clients to stay away from. We have a couple questions we want to bring up, and one of the ones that was brought up was, what does it mean when a stop-loss carrier says that they follow the plan doc? It means they mirror the plan. What they're saying is if it's payable under the terms of the plan, it's payable under the stop-loss policy. That's the best-case scenario. There are very few carriers that actually do that.
you could probably get a carrier that does have a hard gap to have some type of, they don't call it an amendment. What do they call it? Thank you, Brady. An endorsement that will then mirror the plan. So always ask if you can get a special endorsement asking for mirroring, if that's something that would make you or your clients feel a lot more comfortable.
Now, take note, mirroring is a great way to close hard gaps because now the language matches. But always remember, just because you and I have the same exact language, it doesn't mean we interpret that language the same way. So while mirroring is very good and very important, it's not a guarantee that the stop-loss carrier is going to agree with your interpretation of that language. If and when there's ambiguous language or a questionable situation and you're not sure how to interpret the language, that would be one of those scenarios you want to talk to your carrier.
We're getting questions asked in regards to plan document terms, which is a little different than this, but we're being asked if plan docs still like exclude illegal acts, so forth, substance abuse claims, self-inflicted wounds. Yes. I mean, there's a lot of different variation that we're seeing. We're not seeing that in the stop-loss world. In the stop-loss world, we're seeing a definition of exclusion of illegal act, whereas the plan might only exclude felonies. Mm-hmm. So I think any other questions we want to bring up? Oh, I think we're pretty good.
Most of them, I think. Yeah.
Awesome. So listen, everyone, we want to thank you all so much to the thousands of you that dialed in today. We really appreciate it. Our next webinar is going to be October 17th at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. If you want to send us an email or text us or whatever, contact us somehow. You have all of our contact information on LinkedIn, whatever, and give us an idea for a topic for next month. Whoever has the best idea, we will send you some FIA swag. We got some backpacks. We got a bunch of stuff.
Right.
Chargers, FIA pens. Sweatbands.
No.
We have a FIA online store. I mean,
Adam, if I come up with the idea, do I get FIA swag?
Ron, you have plenty of FIA swag already. So on behalf of Ron, Jennifer Coleman, Brady, and myself, thank you so much again. We're very humbled by the fact that so many of you want to dial in every single month. We hope you also tune into Ron and I's podcast. We're actually recording one tomorrow. But on behalf of everyone here at the FIA Group, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your weekend. Goodbye.